I regard myself as a soldier, though a soldier of peace.
I have a dream that one day
a soldier of peace,
this nation will rise up,
a soldier of peace,
live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. I have a dream,
though a soldier of peace.
I have a dream that one day every valley shall be exalted. Every hill and mountain shall be made low, the rough places will be made plain, and the crooked places will be made straight, and the glory of the Lord shall be revealed, and all flesh shall see it.
Nonviolence Radio, covering the beat of nonviolence worldwide, from the Meta Center for Nonviolence in Petaluma, California. Greetings, everybody. This is Stephanie Van Hook, your host of Nonviolence Radio, and I'm here in the studio with my co-host, Michael Negler. We want to start off with David Potter. He works with the Special Programs for Sojourners magazine, and he was in Charlottesville on Friday till Saturday evening. And so I want to invite you, David Potter, to talk a little bit about who Sojourners is, what kind of work you're doing, and what brought you to Charlottesville. What did you see? Just get us caught up.
Well, thank you, Stephanie. It is an honor to be here with you. I work at Sojourners, which is an organization based out of Washington, D.C., that works to articulate the biblical call to justice. We are a progressive Christian organization, and we work to mobilize faith leaders across the country to engage in the work of justice movements. So I was in Charlottesville over the weekend in order to provide coverage for the events that were unfolding, and specifically to follow the actions of a clergy group that were there to stand against in counter-protest to the demonstration in the park. And that organization of clergy and faith leaders was convened by Congregate Charlottesville, and the organizers of that, Brittany Kane Conley and Reverend Seth Wispelway, are really the folks that brought these clergy members to Charlottesville by putting out a call for 1,000 clergy and faith leaders to come join them in solidarity as they worked to confront the ideology of hate that was coming to their city.
Thank you very much, David Potter from Sojourners. Now, you wrote a piece called White Supremacy Versus the Gospel. So can you review a little bit about your impressions of not just what you saw in Charlottesville, but how it made you feel and what you learned?
What I saw in Charlottesville was deeply unsettling. There was waves and waves of demonstrators coming into the park, chanting White Lives Matter, chanting Blood and Soil, and other chants that were used in Nazi Germany, carrying Nazi flags, carrying Confederate flags, and wearing KKK regalia. The images and the symbolism in Charlottesville was deeply unsettling. The clergy group that was there to stand against this ideology that we would call sinful and evil, to stand in a presence of deep abiding love against that.
And to what extent was their counter-protest successful, or what did you see?
There was a moment that really sticks out to me. When we first arrived, the clergy group marched silently from a morning prayer service at a church on the other side of town. They processed from the church to downtown. That silent march really conveyed something very powerful. And then as they entered the street in front of the park, there was a line of paramilitary armed with assault rifles that were essentially guarding the edge of the park where the white supremacist demonstrators were gathered inside of. And this clergy group of about 40 members knelt on the outside of the park face-to-face with these paramilitary individuals. And they offered prayers, they offered song, and the moment that really stands out to me is as there were additional counter-protesters gathering from a number of different groups, engaging in shouting matches with the demonstrators. Almost spontaneously, this clergy group would erupt into song, and they would sing a number of different spirituals, and particularly singing "This Little Light of Mine." And in that moment, there really was something that cut through the shouting and through the anger and through the hate that was present, and told a very different narrative and demonstrated a very different way of being present in that space.
Thank you so much, David Potter from Sojourners, and you wrote White Supremacy versus the Gospel. Can you wrap up with any last thoughts that you have about your main takeaway from what you experienced in Charlottesville?
Mm-hmm. I think at the core of what happened in Charlottesville, we need to understand that white supremacy comes from a sickness. Whiteness is a condition that erodes the soul. It is antithetical to the Christian gospel, and we need to whiteness is something that we need to stand against, and we need to find our identity in something that is true and not built on a lie of human hierarchy.
Great. Thank you so much, David Potter, Director of Special Programs at Sojourners. His article, White Supremacy versus the Gospel, is available at sojo.net. Thanks so much for joining us on Nonviolence Radio.
Thank you, Stephanie.
So that was the beginning of what we're trying to explore today on Nonviolence Radio, is setting the scene for what took place in Charlottesville, where most of the media is covering the violence of what took place. And yet there was an amazing surge of nonviolent action that was also the seeds, at least, were there. And what we want to do is unpack that a little bit more. So next thing I'd like to do is invite my colleague Michael Negler, my co-host and news anchor, to talk a little bit about some of the basic dynamics of nonviolence. It's not what it looks like from the outside. If people think that nonviolence just means standing in protest, that there's a lot more going on under the surface. Michael.
Thank you, Stephanie. You're so right that most of the coverage has completely blindsided this aspect of what did happen there, at least in germ, in Charlottesville. And the way I analyze it is you have these two groups, both of whom are polarized and unable to see a middle ground. You have white supremacists who feel, in a very revealing statement that they often made, we will not be replaced. So, in other words, what they really mean is our supremacy will not be replaced. They mean if we're not supreme, we're nothing. So what they can't grasp, and you know, you really can't blame them given the distortions in our culture, what they can't grasp is that there's a unity in diversity, that they could be very happily emplaced in a diversity of communities and people. And in a way, the hegemony of the United States reflects this same inability to understand that we'd all be much, much happier joining the community of nations instead of trying to dominate it. Now, on the other side, you have the anti-fascists. And when we try to talk to them about nonviolence, what we encounter, just as you were saying a minute ago, Stephanie, is they think we're saying do nothing. They think if you're not doing violence, you're not doing anything. So what they miss is the power of nonviolent response. Now, what David Potter was just sharing leads me to think of an extremely interesting example that unfolded in Birmingham during the civil rights movement, when marchers were blocked by police and firemen. And spontaneously, again, they got down on their knees again and started praying. And after a while, without anyone giving a command, they stood up. And as one of the participants said, we were spiritually intoxicated. Mm-hmm. That is a hint into where the power of nonviolence comes from.
So I want to draw this out for our listeners, because nonviolence is not just a spontaneous reaction. And when you're going into a situation of
escalated conflict and hatred and tensions and violence, and you're just relying on your spiritual intoxication, that's not going to get you that far, because this is what took place, is that there's conflicting stories, but that that folks were, first of all, they're taking nonviolence as you in a level three, really, or a very high level two conflict, where we separate the conflicts out into these three stages of escalation, where the dehumanization rises with each level, and you have to pay attention and escalate your nonviolence each time you see that you've entered into a different phase of the conflict. So really, in a level three conflict, you understand that people are wanting to kill you, and they want to kill other people. And so your nonviolence is going to look a lot different than letter writing or just, you know, plain old protest, or even it has to be a lot more creative or a lot more sacrificial, unfortunately, that's what we call the do or die moment. Now, so if there was a better understanding of the dynamics of nonviolence, what people would be able to see and understand is that they were entering into a level three conflict where they were risking their lives. And because I've heard different stories where some people said, we were doing this and we were hoping we would get arrested, but we see what happened with the police. That didn't happen. So it left room for a group of people or citizens who call themselves anti-fascist, but who were protecting human life and saying, we don't want to see these people get killed. We're going to step in and do the work of what a police officer should do, but we're going to be using violence. These aren't peace teams, you know. And then on the other hand, you have somebody else saying, you know what, we were committed to nonviolence and we were ready for anything in that moment. And we asked the anti-fascists to step back. They did. At first they said, we disagree with what you're doing, but we respect you as people. So that was an interesting interaction. But when they saw that the group of the neo-Nazis crowded around them again, and they were ready to take the next steps and escalate the conflict toward greater acts of violence, that's when the anti-fascists stepped in, and people are saying, well, we're really grateful. But with a very a strategic nonviolent approach, you wouldn't have gotten into that conflict in the first place. You would have done either a creative action that deflected and de-escalated the conflict, or you would have been trained and planned about what that would have looked like, and not drawing upon the need for violence in that situation.
Actually, in that Birmingham episode, people had a lot of training. They didn't have training for what exactly would happen in that moment, but they had a lot of personal preparation, which actually enabled them to face that kind of risk, because the fact is that they got up off their knees and they walked right into the police and firemen. And then an amazing thing happened. This, very segregationist police captain, Bull Connor, said, turn on the hoses. He shouted that out twice at the firemen, and they couldn't. Their hands were, as it were, frozen on the nozzles. And as the marchers quietly walked through this group, they said to them things like, how do you feel about what you're doing? You know, we're here to get our freedom, and we are not going back. So we're not talking about passivity here. We're talking about deep personal preparation, ability to face danger when necessary, and, as you were adding, a very good strategic overview of what you're going to do depending on what comes up.
Mm-hmm. Michael, it seems like we have a caller coming in. Hello, caller.
Hi. I'm calling from Texas. I have a question. I've had this question for a while, but it seems even more pertinent now with what's happened in Charlottesville. And I had a discussion about it with a friend of mine. So the question is it ever okay to punch a Nazi? And when discussing it with my friend, I said, absolutely not. You know, I'm like, well, I've gotten these teachings about nonviolence and everything. But then she sent me an article that supported punching a Nazi, and it was very well written and very, it was very, it made a lot of sense. And then I started to think, well, maybe it is okay in certain situations. So I guess that's my question is it ever okay in any situation to punch a Nazi?
Mm-hmm. What were some of the reasons that were given why it would be okay or when? Do you remember?
I should have reread the article. I think the main point was that a lot of these neo-Nazis and white supremacists, they seem to get away with a lot, and it seems like they're not often stood up to, or so it seems, to the person writing the article. They do what they do often without consequence, and I think that was the writer's main point, was calculating, you know, a calculated punch, not a punch out of retaliation or reactionary, but a calculated punch to a Nazi in certain situations would show them that there are consequences to their actions. I think that was the main point.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for your question. We're gonna explore that now. So the question is, again, to reiterate, is it ever okay then to punch a Nazi? Because there needs to be, the reasoning is that there needs to be some kind of consequence, some immediate consequence to their actions. And if you see this New York Times piece called How to Make Fun of a Nazi, that has interviews by people in this studio, as well as Maria Stefan, who was co-author of a book called Why Civil Resistance Works. She says something amazing in that article. She says, I would love to punch a Nazi, but I know that there's a difference between the practical or effective response and the therapeutic response, where it might feel good to punch a Nazi or to do harm to somebody who is doing harm, but in the long run, it's not effective technique in order to stop what they're doing, because it ends up swelling their ranks and it ends up delegitimating the cause itself for which you're standing, which is you're trying to stand up to hatred. And so we have friends, for example, in a group called the Meta Peace Team, and I'd like to bring Sherry Wanderer on in a bit to talk about the way that there's nonviolent alternatives for helping to de-escalate violence and bring people out of hate groups. But Michael, let's get to that question too of, is it ever okay to use violence? And there are some situations, I suppose, in times in nonviolence when you do have to defend a situation or defend people. But in this, you call this madman with a sword. What are some of the, so say you end up you having to use violence. Now, our caller was suggesting that this isn't a calculated, this is actually use of calculated violence, but you're talking about just a defensive use of violence with madman, where the sword, where you don't plan it out. But can you say more about this?
Gandhi was pretty clear about this point, and I think the one important thing we need to realize about it is this is a very, very rare situation, and it never came up in his entire life. So there's 50 years of working around the clock, facing every kind of contingency, and this situation never did come up. But he said, if you're in a situation where someone is being threatened and you have no other way to defend them, say a Nazi is running towards you, Steph, and I'm standing there and I don't have weapons and he's not listening to me, and I can disable him by, you know, punching him to the ground, I will do the right thing. And the community will be grateful, and you'll be grateful. You're welcome, Stephanie. Thanks. Don't mind her being heroic.
If that wasn't a part of a disciplined, nonviolent response, though, I definitely would not want you to do that. But go ahead.
No, there's no room for a disciplined, nonviolent response. We're proposing. See, that's why the situation is so rare. Mm-hmm. But now, Maria Stefan really did hit the nail on the head when she said it's not therapeutic. I'm not doing it. No, I'm not doing it to feel better. I'm doing it because the situation demands it. And three other things have to happen. I'm not doing it out of anger or fear. I'm not going to whine if there's some injury to me as a consequence, as there very likely would be if the person were a real, honest-to-gosh Nazi. And thirdly and most importantly, I'm not going to develop this as my response to violence down the road. Instead, I'm going to say, why did things degenerate so badly that I had to punch somebody? And I'm going to dedicate the rest of my life to trying to disentangle that so that this never happens to me or anyone else.
Mm-hmm. And there's also somebody who says something like, as with as much energy that we use to prepare for violence, we could use that same energy to prepare for nonviolence. Maybe you're the person who said that in the room.
I said it. I think I was quoting Gandhi there. Mm-hmm. So because this is to show that this has to only be a spontaneous emergency response. Mm-hmm. If you go around thinking, okay, well, I've learned martial arts or I'm carrying a weapon because this might come up again, that preparation could have gone into preparing yourself for nonviolence.
Absolutely. And then we also have this, the bigger, broader picture of then judging people who have used violence or in a situation. And that's really not the point of nonviolence, is saying that you're not being nonviolent enough for me, so we can't get along or we can't work together. That's not the point. If somebody is making a choice that's different from mine, that's totally fine. But it's the self-searching and the knowing where one's own commitment is and what one is or is not willing to do. And when you make a commitment to nonviolence, you need to get support and you need to have a broader community of people who are supporting you and getting training and getting you into the world, into a place where you feel like your gifts meet the needs of the world.
It's commitment, and I would also add, Stephanie, it's a question of knowing your own stage of preparation. There are times when I feel I might be able to simply step in the way and say, vent your anger on me, not on that other person. And there are times when I would have to lash out, just depending on how much training I'd had.
Mm-hmm.
But again, I certainly wouldn't judge another person who felt that because they didn't have the training, violence was the only way they knew of to protect somebody.
Right. And we need to really avoid that kind of conversation in our interactions with people, because it's keeping us from uniting together against hatred by keeping us at odds with each other of you chose the wrong technique or you made a different decision that I don't know if I would have made in that situation or not. But I hope that I would have, you know, those kinds of conversations end up dividing us more. But then what I really like to talk about is the power of disciplined, trained, nonviolent people who are knowing what they're walking into, or they're doing creative actions instead of directly confronting situations or constructive actions. And one of my favorite groups is the Meta Peace Team. That's Meta with one T, and they are out of Michigan. And they are KKK rallies and neo-Nazi marches and are not new to this group, because they are asked to come in and help communities when violent groups are coming in to help de-escalate the violence between the those who are signing up for the hate group and those people who hate the haters. And there's high tension and high possibility for the escalation of violence. Now, one of our friends from this group, Sherry Wonder, has told a story before that we love at the Meta Center, because it highlights that there is another way for dealing with white supremacists and Nazi marches. And this is a story that, the Meta Peace Team was invited to basically an anti-fascist rally, and somebody was there wearing and had swastikas on and basically was a Nazi, and he ends up getting beat up by the crowd. So we want to hear a little bit about the work of the Meta Peace Team and how they got into that situation and what happened. Let's see.
I think one of the things that I believe nonviolence is about listening to the voices and following the leadership of those most impacted by violence. And so for example, when the KKK rallied in Ann Arbor, Michigan back in 98, the Meta Peace Team, which at that time was the Michigan Peace Team, placed a violence reduction peace team. And I will be the first one to say we were new to this and we made a lot of mistakes. But I think that one of the things that we did right was that we listened to the voices of those most targeted. So at that particular rally, the KKK said they were coming to target African Americans, Jewish Americans, and queer Americans. Like, that was their stated target. And so we talked with people in those communities. I mean, as somebody who identifies as queer, I talked to my friends and allies doing queer liberation work. And we reached out to a number of other folks working in the African American communities, in the Jewish communities, to say, what is it that we can do? What support do you need? What does it look like to be an ally in this moment for you? And what we heard back over and over and over again is create a safe space away from the KKK rally for people to be. Now, that's not the only thing we did, but we got a lot of criticism for doing that. And I think one of the things that we didn't do well is we didn't communicate well why we did it. And the reality is why we did it is because the leadership within the communities being targeted said, this is how to be a good ally to us today. Really beautiful moment came when there was a man and his girlfriend in the crowd, and they were there to support the KKK. It's a really warm day. Everybody's in shorts and t-shirts, and this guy's got on this big leather jacket. So clearly he's somebody that we want to pay attention to. So we had a group of people that kind of wandered around and shadowed him and just were aware of what was going on. He takes off his jacket and he has swastikas tattooed all over him. And the crowd sort of forms a circle and starts, yelling at him, out Nazi scum, and yelling at him. And someone breaks a bottle over his head. And the peace team stepped in. They surrounded him and his girlfriend. They escorted them out of the crowd, offered to get an ambulance, provided first aid, and when they declined the ambulance, they escorted them to the car. The particular peace team, that affinity team that took that action, was made up of an African-American woman, an Asian-American woman, and a man who identified himself as a quote-unquote queer Jew. He loved to really put the language in your face. And as they were escorting this couple out of town, this man said to them, I want to point out to you that an African-American, an Asian-American, and a queer Jew just saved your life today. And the man said nothing. He was very quiet, kind of looked down at the ground. But his girlfriend said, maybe we all bleed the same blood after all. So that's one example. What would you tell people to do to prepare to come to an event? I think the thing that I would also say, not just to come to an event, but to do any of this work, is to reflect on your own racism, ableism, the ways that white supremacy and ableism and all of those things are rooted in your own heart and in your own life and in your own community. Because sometimes on the surface, it looks like, you took the hardest act by punching the Nazi, right? But that is easy compared to acknowledging the white supremacy, the racism, the heterosexism, the cisism in your own person and in your own community. And what happened, in Charlottesville, what happens at these rallies, that's the tip of the iceberg. And the thing about the Meta Peace team that I really appreciate is that all of us who are active in that work are active in dismantling those systemic injustices way beyond the moment of what is happening in the street. So I think that is really important.
There is an indefinable, mysterious power that pervades everything. It transcends the senses. While everything around me is ever-changing, ever-dying, there is a living power that is changeless, that holds all together, that creates, dissolves, and recreates.
Now let's turn to something that you're not going to get, except for in this New York Times article that made it in this week. Go to the New York Times and find an article about making fun of Nazis. It's an unfortunate title of the piece, but you get into it. It's kind of like a clickbait title about, and you get into it and you say, well, there's a right way of engaging nonviolence in situations of escalated violence, and it explores that. So do check that out. But we don't get a lot of nonviolence in the news, and so there's nonviolence happening all over the place. What's going on, Michael Negler?
Thank you, Stephanie. Right. Yeah, we would have called that article something like How to Confront or Deal With, because we don't want to be provocative, and we certainly don't want to be humiliating. That's something that Gandhi felt very strongly about. But it is otherwise an absolutely excellent article, and we've already gotten requests. For example, on Tuesday, we will be interviewed by another radio station. It's called KPFA down in Berkeley. We'll be interviewed by Chris Welch. So, again, to share with you some other resources from Waging Nonviolence earlier this month, they had an article called Sahrawi Refugees Build Their Nation in Exile. And we're going to be hearing from Professor Stephen Zunis on the West Saharan struggle, which is a struggle the world has ignored, but is an extremely grieving one, agonizing one, and also one where the nonviolence has been maintained for a long time. These Western Saharans or Sahrawis have been in refugee camps now, and here's one quote from the article from Waging Nonviolence. This 200,000-person camp is run by the refugees themselves. Any international organizations that come in do so as partners, not as leaders. And I wanted to stress that because this is an important lesson that the intervention movement has learned very quickly in our career, going back about 30 years now in terms of modern third-party nonviolence intervention, that we want to avoid something that's called peace imperialism, where you sweep in and tell people what to do and then sweep out. Instead, as Sherry Wander was saying, the first job is to listen to the people who have invited you in. And I can never forget going to a meeting down here in Santa Cruz some 20 years ago where Mubarak Awad from Nonviolence International was present. He was still operating in Palestine. He had not yet been deported. And we asked him, Mubarak, do you want us in there? And he said, which I'll never forget, he said, absolutely, we are willing to die. We do not want to die alone. So come in, but do not tell us what to do. So that's an important principle that this institution has learned. Now, I wanted to turn to an article because of what we heard from David Potter from a magazine called Crux, which is the online magazine of the Catholic News Service. They had an article called West Bank Priests Stress Nonviolence as Youths Protest Israeli Occupation. You know, throughout the West Bank and Gaza and, in fact, other areas of the world, it is the Shabab, the young people, the young men, who are very difficult. This happened also at Standing Rock. When I say very difficult, I mean it's difficult for them to control their anger, perfectly understandable, but it's crucial that they do so. And they have a lot of power when they succeed in doing it. And there is a Catholic priest there, Father Firas Arida, who had a beautiful quote that I want to share with you. He said, I tell the young men that we are not with this violence. If we do not accept for Israel to behave this way, then how can we accept it from our side? Wherever God is represented in our life, we should have no violence. So one more resource before I move on into the news section, that is that Project Censored, that you may be familiar with from at Sonoma State University, they now have been adopted on 18 campuses. And I'd particularly like to draw your attention to the one on San Francisco State, where a good friend of ours, Professor Ken Burrows, has developed an approach called constructive media. I bet you weren't surprised that we were very enthused by the idea of constructive media. He says it is not fear-based and not problem-focused. They focus on social health news, mindfulness, technology and eco-health, and other fascinating things. So to move on to some of the news, I can't really cover even a fraction of it this week. I wanted to highlight one stirring event. This comes to us from Common Dreams, and I'm quoting the title of their article. In support of 8 arrested for toppling Durham statue, hundreds turned themselves in. And Common Dreams correctly identified this as a pure act, a true act of civil disobedience. 8 people had been arrested for pulling down a statue of a Confederate general, and hundreds of others said, arrest us too. So it's a wonderful technique. But it leads me to make a few comments about this whole practice of tearing down statues. I perfectly understand why people are doing it, but I've got some problems. So hear me out. First of all, I want to say, let's not forget, statues are symbols. And in nonviolence, symbols are tricky. The side that relies on symbols while the other side is making concrete changes is going to lose. For one thing, to rely on symbols sends a message that there isn't anything concrete to do, or that you can't think of anything concrete to do. And that's a bad message. Symbols can also be misinterpreted. And in fact, this has led to our president, no comments, please, saying that, you know, we're destroying culture and history. And it's, you know, I don't agree with the statement, but there is a grain of truth there because symbols can always be misinterpreted. And after all is said and done, these people whose statues are being torn down are part of the history of that area. Second, as is often the case with symbols, these acts are highly provocative, and that is not smart when you're dealing with white supremacists and neo-Nazis. So I think it's both counterproductive and a waste of energy. Thirdly, what about the dignity of the South? Some Southerners will feel like this is the Civil War all over again. So how could we go about this in a way that would bring them along with us? And this is going to take some time. The real way to solve problems in the long run through nonviolence is rarely a quick fix, though we have focused today on some dramatic episodes. So I can think of 3 things that we should do. Patiently educate people about the marvelous diversity of nature and the equality of the human spirit. Second, put up statues that celebrate the great men and women of the South. Every time you pull down a Confederate general, put up a musician or a physicist or a great surgeon. And my final comment is all war memorials should come down, and they should come down voluntarily, not by being torn down by one party or the other. So thank you for hearing me out. I, as I say, I'm not opposing this action altogether, but I wish we could be doing something a little more effective. Yesterday on the Sojourners website, there was a statement by 350 Christian ethicists. They were condemning white supremacy. And again, there's some beautiful language there that I wanted to share with you. Quote, white supremacy and racism deny the dignity of each human being revealed through the incarnation. Through faith, we proclaim that God the Creator is the origin of all human persons. Moving on to some other items now. Campaign Nonviolence is still going forward with its week of actions, September 16th to 24th, coming up fairly soon now, and they have nearly 800 local actions scheduled. So they're on their way to their goal of 1,000 marches, rallies, vigils, and other forms of witness to take place next month. Going a little further afield, in South Korea, the peace movement soldiers on despite lack of any obvious success. And that's an important principle. We know it from Central America, where it was called Firmeza Permanente, or the party that really has what St. Teresa of Avila used to call determinación, will eventually prevail. And the interesting thing about the South Korean peace movement now, in the face of much provocation, of course, is that it is not just the Catholic 50% of South Korea, but Buddhists also have gotten heavily involved. And that has not always been the case. Korean Buddhists, as opposed to their Christian confreres, have not traditionally been active. They were rather quietist. They were not participating in what Thich Nhat Hanh calls engaged Buddhism. So when they did get involved, some individuals jumped right into extreme acts like self-immolations, which, of course, had been taking place in Vietnam. And needless to say, an act like that should be the very last thing, not the very first act of nonviolent resistance, if it's going to happen at all. But to go back to the Catholic activists, there's a Father Mun who declared that he was asked why you continue in the face of his overwhelming power, your own government and the United States. He said, "The truth cannot be thrown away. The truth will stand up someday. The truth is very powerful. So I believe the truth is going to win all enemies." One of the issues that they're protesting is the placement of Terminal High Altitude Area Defense Missile System, THAAD, which have been put in the city of Busan on land that is dangerously close to some Buddhist pilgrimage sites and so forth. So it's a little bit parallel to what we saw in Standing Rock. So while we're at it, the Coalition Against Foreign Military Bases is a new campaign in the U.S., which is focused on closing all U.S. military bases abroad. If I'm not mistaken, there are about 750 of them. And it strikes at the foundation of the what they're calling the U.S. empire, and they're urging us to join that campaign. Again, Coalition Against Foreign Military Bases. And now to turn to the question of the environment. From our ever-reliable colleagues, Nonviolent Conflict News, from the International Center for Nonviolent Conflict, ICNC, they reported earlier this month about a group called Swaraj India. Swaraj, of course, was Gandhi's term for independence. It had meant personal spiritual freedom, but he applied it to, well, it had already been applied to the political independence of India. And his classic text that he wrote in 1909 was called Hind Swaraj, or Indian Home Rule, Indian Independence. So there have been hunger strikes there to protest the government increasing the height of the Sardar Sarovar Dam. That is a dam, a part of a big system of dams that are blocking the Narmada River in Gujarat state. A sacred river, I might add. And this protest called Vigil for Narmada was attended by over 100 Swaraj India workers, including their founder, Yogendra Yadav, and they had organizations like Greenpeace and National Alliance of People's Movements who joined the agitation. I like that because it's a good example of the kinds of collaboration that are springing up all over it, and the anti-siloism that we need so badly. But Yadav stated, quote, "With the raising of the dam's height from 122 to 138.6 meters, at least 40,000 families stand at a risk of being submerged." And he said both the state and the center government are to be blamed for what he calls mass murder. Totally sympathize, but I'm just wondering if maybe that mass murder could be considered an exaggeration against which Gandhi would be kind of nervous. But anyway, it's good for us to know that this is a continuation of a long struggle that was carried out by an earlier organization, the Narmada Bachao Andolan, or the Narmada Saving Movement, which was led by a venerable sage, Baba Amte, and a young woman Mehta Patkar, who's still active in India. Baba Amte has passed away. So that Narmada Bachao Andolan was one of two major environmental struggles going on in the immediate post-Gandhi era, the other one being Chipko Andolan, or the tree-hugging movement that took place up in the north. Still on the environment, we're often looking to Germany for their energetic, no pun intended, and imaginative, creative successes. There's a program called Energiewende, which means energy transformation, and their aim is to have 80% of the country's energy generated from renewables by 2050, which is a little bit under our target here in California, but still quite laudable. And Truth Out, which sends us this article, has stated, and I think correctly, that there's many lessons there for other countries who want to transform away from fossil fuels. A little bit closer to home now. Last week, a man in Petaluma was arrested for blocking a truck packed with live chickens. And this is part of the Direct Action Network, and the activists were holding up signs saying, quote, "No hate for truckers, just love for animals." I thought that was a very, very nice sentiment. Some things that are coming up. Now, as most of us know, there is another rally being planned to take place in San Francisco at Crissy Field on the 26th. And, sure enough, a counter-protest that's being planned by, several different operations there. The one I want to share with you is Loved Up Mobile Dance Counter-Protest, which will take place at the Marina Green. Mm-hmm. And they describe it with three very important and very inspiring characteristics. It is non-confrontational, non-violent, and off-site, but nearby. Mm-hmm. Well, I guess I have time to mention just one other thing. It's down the road, but end of February, beginning in March, group called the Selma Center for Nonviolence, Truth, and Reconciliation is having a two-day plus three-more-day training in Kingian nonviolent conflict resolution. They'll teach the six principles of Kingian nonviolence, basic ideas, strategies, and so forth, and then a five-day core training. This, of course, is the 53rd anniversary of the Bloody Sunday. Thank you very much.
So thank you so much, Michael Negler, for that nonviolence in the news. I'd like to add a couple extra resources. One is that on today's show, we spoke with David Potter from Sojourners with their own special approach to nonviolence and social justice through the Christian faith. We emphasize the need for training and the need for practice, and Sherry Wander also emphasized that. So there is... There's trainings happening all over. Please do find some, and I'm offering one on Saturday at the Meta Center, but you can just keep getting involved in finding it. There's a resource on terrorism and nonviolence, because if we are calling hate groups terrorist organizations, then we also have to understand there's a nonviolent response to terrorism, too, and that we can begin to respond nonviolently and learn about that. You can find that at the Meta Center's website. And finally, we have a weekly call that explores nonviolence in the news as we're partnering up with Waging Nonviolence. So if that's something that you'd like to learn about, it's Wednesday mornings from 8:15 to 9:15 every week, and you can join that call, too.
Dedicated to all spiritual activists, true seekers, and peaceful warriors worldwide.
I regard myself as a soldier, though a soldier of peace.
Once upon a time, not long ago, there was a boy who would grow and become a great soul. He lived in India, and his name was Gandhi. He believed in human rights, and he fought for equality. He felt so strongly that he trained himself, because he realized first he'd have to change himself. He changed his clothes and decided to walk. Some days he practiced silence and refused to talk. When he was young, he studied to be a lawyer. And then he became a great spiritual warrior. He read from the scriptures of every religion and came to the realization that we're all God's children. Because he understood that we're all equal, he became a spokesman for the people. A karma yogi devoted to service, to spread truth and peace was his purpose. You gotta be the change that you wanna see in the world. Be the change, just like Gandhi. Be the change that you wanna see in the world. just like Gandhi. Gandhi dedicated his life to the cause, even when it meant breaking unjust laws. He often faced prison and incarceration, but that only strengthened his determination. He said he would make every sacrifice, but that he would never kill or take a life. He used his heart instead of his fist, and he taught nonviolence as the way to resist. A peaceful soldier who used his mind to fight for the rights of humankind, but not just people, animals too. In his basic teaching, God is truth. He joined Muslims, Sikhs, and Hindus, Christians, Buddhists, Jains, and Jews. All the many paths that lead into the light that shines bright inside of me and you. You gotta be the change that you wanna see in the world. Be the change, just like Gandhi.